This is a Power 98.7 podcast. Now we're talking. Subscribe to Power 98.7 podcasts in iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. There's more on power987.co.za.
Here's a conversation that, of course, I've been following and dealing with throughout my journalistic career from 1994 and being an observer of politics in essence before 1994. We didn't just all suddenly, you know, emerge in 1994. A lot of other things would have got us here. In fact, aspects of our democracy were written with, into the lives of other people. Chris Hani, for example, would have died on the 10th of April, 1993. His assassination, a huge role in how our democracy actually turned out and how those negotiations began to play out. So, too, I can also talk about Anton Lubowski. And Anton Lubowski, 12th of September, 1989, 37 years old only at that particular time. Brilliant, brilliant attorney in Namibia. And of course, you'll remember, if you remember at that particular point, then the Namibian-South African relation in essence and the links between those two countries and the sort of influence South Africa would have had and the nature of that particular influence that South Africa had on a country like Namibia all those years ago, Southwest Africa. So yes, a lot has come in our democracy, and as we even talk about where we are today and the negotiations and who, you know, would get what kind of spoils from those particular aspects, one sometimes needs to go back and reflect on various aspects of other things, of how we got here. Lots of other people would have sacrificed their lives. Like I said, Chris Hani being one, 10 April 1993, at around 10:20 in the morning. We all remember that particular story. And then there was a story of Anton Lubowski. And that was somewhat of a massive story in the South African context already, because in as much as it came a few years earlier on, it began to illustrate what and how the system was fighting back against the forces that wanted to get us here today. I'm pleased to say that today, in the conversation, I am going to be joined by Nadia Lubowski, daughter of Anton Lubowski, and also by retired High Court Judge Chris Nicholson. Christopher Robert Nicholson. Let me bring them both into the conversation and so I could engage both of them. So, Nadia, welcome to Power 98.7. Welcome to Power Perspective. Nadia?
Hi, Denzel.
How are you, Nadia?
I'm good. Thank you so much for granting us the opportunity to have this conversation.
Sure. And Chris Nicholson, Judge Chris Nicholson, how are you?
I'm fine, thank you. And again, thanks for having us on your show.
Sure, it's an absolute pleasure, Nadia. If you don't mind, I'm going to start with the retired judge, because I can take advantage of him. I think he's much older than both me and you, so I'll take advantage of him, Nadia. And I'll start here, Christopher Robert Nicholson. Related to Peter and Graham Pollock, and also somebody called Ravenna Nicholson, and then also related to Alan Payton. Was it something, Chris, that went along the lines of this? They saw you playing, they saw you trying to play cricket, and they said, go and do law rather.
Sounds a bit yeah, so maybe the blood from the Peyton went through into my veins, and the Pollock blood, you know, the Springbok cricketers, that eluded me possibly.
Yeah. So I looked at all of that and I was thinking, what would have been the shift? Look, what is your best in essence? 3 for 58?
Well, you know, that's the only first-class game I ever played in. I played for South African universities against what was Northern Transvaal.
Yeah.
So that's the only record of my cricket career, you know, on the internet. So that's the only
That's the only one I could find.
Is that right?
That's the only one I could find, Chris. Right. Chris, when did you know you had something to write, that you could write? Apart from needing to deal with all the judgments in front of you and the aspect of writing in that particular case, when did you have an understanding that there was something more, that there was a book or two or three or four or five or six within you?
You know, I was a human rights lawyer with the Legal Resources Center, and our office dealt with the inquest into the Craddock Four. Matthew Goniwe, you obviously remember them, Fort Galata and them. And the first inquest was dealt, and all the inquests were, the families were represented by us. And at a conference of our officers, I said that would make a very good book, and I saw everybody looking at me. So I said, am I the one to write this book? So I wrote a book about the Craddock Four.
Yeah, who killed the Craddock Four, yeah.
Yeah. And I'm glad that's now going to be a reopened inquest, so maybe there'll be justice at last there for those people.
Sure. And would there be a sequel in essence then to that? Would you automatically think of, you know, extending that particular space?
Once I'd written that, I live in a road just off Crisani Highway, so I would always look at that and say, you know, somebody has got to write up the Chris Harney story. And I was always reminded of what Nelson Mandela said, you know, when he received the Chris Harney Award. Mm. He said, the fateful day of Chris Harney's brutal murder is indelibly etched on the hearts of all freedom-loving people. Mm. And no one will be satisfied until the truth about his death is known. Mm. So I decided to spend more than 10 years trying to, unearth the real truth behind. You know, we know that Janusz Wolus fired the shots and he was sent there by
Clive Darby Lewis. Mm.
But, you know, who were the manipulators behind the scenes? Were they merely puppets in a much bigger scheme of things? That was what really interested me.
Chris, I'm gonna get there in a second, and just for purposes of this particular interview, Chris and Nadia, I want to acknowledge that I did not read the book. It came at me yesterday. I tried to glance at some instances. I know the story both of Chris Harney and, of course, Anton Lubowski pretty well. I've followed those particular stories into the TRC, into all other phases, and Chris, I'm really keen to read the book and find out where exactly you're going, because these several conspiracy theories have been around forever. Nadia, let me come to you, Nadia. And the link between Anton Lubowski and Chris Harney, almost to a T the same, coming pre a democracy in a particular country, Chris Harney coming 1 year in essence almost to the democracy in South Africa, Anton Lubowski, I think 3 months was it, Nadia, before the independence elections in Namibia, would that be as how close it would have been?
Yes, he was murdered in September. Independence then happened in March.
That's it.
So that was 6 months later. But the elections, I think, took place in November. No. Yeah, I can't remember the exact elections. But I remember being a child that my dad had taken us to a queue where we were doing the sort of the pre, because he was so involved in the run-up to the election that he involved us as children right from the start.
Yeah.
And there's actually a very photo that was taken while we're standing next to him in one of those queues. He got taken out very, very close to independence actually already being underway.
Yeah,
which is the reason why I would say that everybody that is listening has to buy this book.
Mm.
And to take it to another extreme, it needs to be part of our historical documentation.
Mm. Yeah. Do you draw parallels, Nadia? Do you? I mean, you know, you know the role your dad played, the influence he had, and when other people engage Chris Hani like they do, and a lot of people also having understanding of Anton Lubowski's contribution to the South African context, to the Namibian political scene as well. Do you draw parallels, as I have in this particular instance, to people who would have been assassinated for the roles they played, the important roles they played, because maybe of the influence they would have had post those particular elections and post those democracies? Do you draw parallels?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, and this is... again, it's something that really Chris, and hopefully we have the time to unpack and explore some of this, you know, with him, because most of the parallels that Chris has drawn in his book are so explosive in the sense that it's something we as a family have always known. So that just, you know, so we don't really have a story that draws any close to what actually happened, who gave the order. We know that it was CCB members, but most of the pieces have been haven't really been revealed yet. And we definitely as a family knew a lot of it, but had no real, I suppose, even an ability to actually put those parallels together, even though we did know them. And the gratitude that we feel towards Chris for having had the courage to write this book and to the amount, the extensive research and the detail that he goes into and how it's all pieced together. Because, and I'd like Chris to obviously unpack it more.
Yeah,
and because he knows the book inside out. But it's these parallels that are actually so shocking and in many ways quite nauseating, that people like Chris Hani, like my father, and Patrice Lumumba and all the ones that he mentions in the book, how they stood up for something that is so profoundly significant in terms of where we find ourselves today. So we thought it was a political, you know, everyone always thought it was a political murder, but it's not actually a political murder, it's actually an economical one.
Yeah. Well, slash political too, because the players might have been political in essence.
Yeah, of course. Yeah. But the fact that these worlds are so interlinked, and the impact that it's had now goes far wider. Now the impact is political. It is
absolutely
economical. It is social justice. It's even environmental.
Yeah.
If you hear about,
no, I've
hear
got you.
More about what's taken place.
Let's go to Chris. Chris, I'm going to, and I think Chris, Nadia has laid the foundation nicely, and I'm going to draw stuff to, you know, just draw back to my own historical context so that you don't have to repeat it, but you can build on it. A lot of these conspiracies in a lot of cases, Anton Lubowski, of course, there was the South African Civil, Corporation Bureau, the CCB. A lot of people were in that. Ferdinand Barnard was in it. Karl Botha was in it. Abraham van Zyl, Slang van Zyl was in it. We knew of the players. In fact, Donald Acheson is then said to be held responsible for that particular murder, and political as it was by the South African side, because that particular institution was an institution of the South African Defence Force at the time. Let's go to Chris Hani on the other side. Several conspiracy theories that made the rounds a lot and maybe still do. Joe Modise was named, actually formally by Terry Crawford Brown, at the Arms Deal Commission. If you just go there, you can see that there was an economic and or corruption, system that maybe, you know, Chris Hani had stumbled onto there. Thabo Mbeki is the famously one also that particular conspiracy theory drags him into a collusion between Clive Darby Lewis and the other. I'll just name them for you and just see if you talk to them. There were national intelligence reports from Flakplaas and other places as well, county intelligence, that drove a particular narrative. Janusz Walusz's wife, Gay Darby Lewis, was in court, Supreme Court here in Johannesburg, acquitted in essence. Then, of course, the people who did, of course, admit to it and were sentenced, Clive Darby Lewis and Janusz Walusz, 1992, there's an attempt on Chris Hani in the streets of Johannesburg by someone who then runs off into a vehicle. But that, of course, the police don't investigate. Patrick Glongwana. If you remember Patrick Glongwana, former detainee in the ANC in Angola, also known by Harry Maringa, they were the Returned Exile Committee group, security policemen in essence, trying to infiltrate the ANC. He obviously went on TV, if you Google it, you'll find it, and said they were going to, in fact, assassinate ANC leaders and MK leaders because of what had happened. And so you can go through a variance of, you know, conspiracy theories in this particular aspect. Do you go through them all and do you nullify them and then you go somewhere else? How do you play with every single thing that I've given you to try to give us something that makes sense and closer to the truth?
Denzel, you are very close to the truth, but you know, the big bogey word is conspiracy theory. So as with a legal background, one tries to establish the facts. And, you know, a simple way of looking at it is to say, who provided the car for Janusz Waluch to drive and kill Chris Hani on the 10th of April? Mm. It was a businessman called Peter Jackson. So The world of economics or business is involved. Who provided the gun? And you'll find military intelligence are involved. It went down a few lines of people.
Yeah.
And then who arranged that the security guards were not on duty that night, that day? And you find ANC security system arranged for that. Now, there is a feature which I found most exciting, and that was when Janusz Waluch applied for amnesty, you know, before the TRC, a researcher, St. Peter Blanche's daughter, Christelle, was given a file. And in that file, there were 10 documents. And the 10 documents didn't talk about Chris Hani at all. Someone had sanitized that file and left these 10 documents, thinking they had nothing to do with Chris Hani. They came from an organization called the South African Institute of Maritime Research. And that the documents talked about the killings of Patrice Lumumba and Dag Hammarskjöld.
Yeah.
And
September 1961, both in September 1961.
Yes.
Yeah.
And so I started thinking, now, what is this organization, SIMAR, South African Institute of Maritime Research?
Yeah.
And one of the most fascinating parts of the book, if I may boast about is the quest to find out what that was. Was it linked to British intelligence? And, you know, if I can tantalize readers or your listeners with that, in the end, I find it's very closely linked to British intelligence. So British intelligence and British companies had huge investments in South Africa. And, you know, Chris Hani, being a communist and a man who adhered to the Freedom Charter, he wanted to redistribute the wealth in South Africa. And the Brits and the Americans, the foreign companies, they wanted the business to stay in their hands and possibly share it with a few of the black elite, which probably happened thereafter. I'm sure you're well aware. So if one starts pursuing that organization, and one then looks to an incredible interrogation, Janusz Waluch, on the Wednesday following the Saturday, you know, he was arrested on the Saturday in the middle of the Easter weekend. But four nights later, he was interrogated for 11 hours by two suspicious characters. And during that night, 11-hour interrogation, he was persuaded not to divulge who was really behind his killing. And so he was threatened with death, I'm convinced, because that's the only reason you don't tell on those people. And he then agreed to restrict the case to himself and Clive Darby Lewis. So that's why he's now, you know, he went to the TRC and he was refused amnesty because the judges found he hadn't told the whole truth. So in my book, I try to explore this organization, SIMAR, linked to British intelligence and involved in killings possibly from the early 60s I don't know if you remember the Seychelles episode.
Yes,
you're
yes.
Too young for that, I'm sure.
No, I read a lot, Chris.
So, you know, we attempted, or somebody attempted, to topple a socialist government there of a man called René. And again, the Saimaa organization was involved in that. So you're seeing, you know, the deadly hand of intelligence forces, maybe the South African intelligence, maybe big corporates involved with that, and British intelligence involved as well. So that's, for me, the part that hopefully takes it away from conspiracy theory and makes it more in the realm of who were the manipulators, were these two puppets, and were they accomplices? I'm sure you know your law, and the accomplices are those who helped the commission of the murder, knowing that it was going to take place. Do you know, if you give a car to Janusz Walusz knowing he's going to drive and kill Chris Harney, you're an accomplice and you're guilty of murder, you know. And if you arrange that the security guards aren't going to be on duty, you're an accomplice. Also, if you provide the weapon, you know. So that's really where I explored the complicity of others.
Let me just ask you this, Chris. How do you prevent an aspect of, once I've read the book, and I'm going to read the book, and I can't really wait to read the book, how do you get to a point where you also don't want to be a conspiracist at the end of the book? It could have been, you know, in aspect. At the end of the book, do you give me a clear understanding that, you know, this is more or less where, you know, it is, or do you get to a specific place, or do you leave me with a better understanding of, you know, the workings of that time and the individuals that were at play?
Well, that's a very good question. And I try to place the reader in the position of a jury member, assuming this jury trial.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So you play judge in the book as well?
No, I
say, you know, somebody who's listening to all the arguments, and then the jury obviously talks to the judge and says, we you know, my lord, find that, you know, you're there, you're in that particular setup. Not in somebody who plays judge in the sense of you make a judgment call on something.
No. Yeah. In the second class chapter, if you want to, if it gets too boring, and I hope it doesn't, if you read the second to last and the last chapters, I try and do the sort of summing up a judge would do to a jury, where he says, you know, members of the jury, this is the evidence.
That's
now
it.
You must decide who you think was responsible.
Yeah.
Were they accomplices? You know, obviously, Janusz. There's another very interesting point, Denzel, and that is, was there a second shooter there? You know, was there a second person firing rounds? And, you know, Janusz Walusz was caught by the policeman about 10 minutes later. You recall an Afrikaans woman saw
She had recognized the vehicle.
That's right. She took down their number plate.
Yeah.
And, you know, 10 minutes later, Janusz Walusz was caught red-handed with it. But, you know, he hadn't even put on the false number plates because, I don't know, it was moved from the Sunday to the Saturday, and I think he hadn't got round to putting the false number plates on. But they were bought like 3 months before, so there was intense planning, long-term planning for this killing, which means that it goes much further than just Janusz Walusz and
Clive Darby Lewis.
Yeah.
Nadia, back to you, Nadia. The South African connection to Anton, who is in, of course, Windhoek and Namibia, is real. Understanding the politics of South Africa and Southwest Africa at the time, and, you know, also the aspects of what was going on in Namibia, and who SWAPO was, and the dynamics of all of that. Also, Anton's role in that particular organization as well. But we get to the TRC, and I'll also go to Chris about this. We get to the TRC, and very, very little emerges, and very little is known. And maybe even to this day, I would make a suggestion to you, and maybe you tell me differently, that maybe even today you don't know pretty much more than I would if I went and, you know, spent 30 years looking at it as I have as a journalist, and having covered the TRC all of those times and you know, followed the Anton Lubowski story pretty well. And then the names of Barnard and Karl Botha and Abram Slang and Flakplaas coming into that as well, understanding also how David Webster would have lost his life with people just mysteriously dying but no answers. Are you any closer? Are you any closer, apart from the book that now begins to, you know, open different avenues for you? Was it a massive disappointment that, you know, forever and a day, through the TRC and all the, the various judicial inquests that would have been held, that still today you might not genuinely know, apart from the names that would have been associated, Donald Acheson, and then I said Ferdinand Barden and Barnard, Karl Booth and Abraham van Zyl, and then Flakplaas, you know, individuals as well?
So you ask incredibly good questions.
I'm sorry, Nadia.
No, you do. I mean, you ask very good questions. The only thing is, there's, if you follow the linear answer to that, I would say that, yes, it has in many ways been disappointing that my father's death has never been, there's never been any form of resolve or any form of answers or any form of, like, being able to actually complete the question why. Because it was just, you know, Namibia was accomplished in getting its independence from Southwest Africa. You know, the thing that he worked and fought for were all slowly falling into place. So why still kill him? But yet, you know, the TRC, no one came forward to ask for amnesty. My grandparents appeared at the TRC asking for somebody to come forward, and no one did. Then there was in-camera interviews done with that really despicable man.
Was it Ferdy Barnard? Magnus Malan, who actually then went on with the disinformation campaign.
Correct.
Yeah.
And there was in-camera sessions done with him during the TRC that then were revealed to Saha later, and they had, you know, they went, dumped many hoops to get these documents to even be released. Sweden flew up to Johannesburg to go and read, and yet it was basically just more of the mess that was the intention of the CCB. The CCB was put into place to create chaos and to unsettle things. So from that perspective, it was clear why, you know, they would have been pulled into it. But the same MO happened with the Chris Hani assassination, and that there was two separate killings. So there was my father, there was the AK-47, and he was killed just by a driving car. And then there was a revolver that was used to kill him and shoot him in the head. And the thing was that later that night, a roadblock had been set up out towards the airport, where Donald Acheson was then found with a gun in his, you know, was supposed to be found with a gun in his boot, but he'd gotten rid of it. So Donald Acheson was going to be the fall guy, but then would have been accused of the murder, and then it kind of could be easily tied up and then packed away. And that's why, because his book is called not Who Killed Chris Hani, but Who Really Killed Chris Hani. Because there's a poor guy that gets set up to do the killing, but actually it's a whole myriad of reasons why he was then actually assassinated.
Because
in some ways, the linear answer.
Because you know, when I throw the parallels, Nadia, the circumstances are almost, you know, you can see them. There's the assassination that is done in Chris Hani's particular way, in the driveway. Same with Anton at the house. There's a vehicle that is searched and found. Donald Acheson is that particular person. In Chris Hani instance, the vehicle is immediately also reported to, you know, in instance, somebody locates the vehicle and says, here it is. And so, and then, of course, all the conspiracy theories that then deal with the political and the economic in the economic space. Let me ask you this and just jump a little forward. Do you get some solace, Nadia, from the fact that the melody played at, you know, Anton's funeral, composed, of course, by, what was it, Duasab, I think, Exali Duasab?
Yes.
It's the same, it became the melody for the Namibian national anthem. Is there some solace that, you know, every time that anthem is played, that, you know, Anton Lubowski is in fact honored in a very, very, you know, respectful way?
So I would say yes and no.
Yeah.
You know, there's four streets named after him. One in Upington, because he did that very famous Upington 25 case.
Yeah.
There's three in Namibia. And there's various ways that you know, he appears at Heroes Acre, which we were asked, you know, especially by the government at the time, which were all these gestures that would, to some degree, provide some kind of solace, which yes, I would say yes, but also a very big no, because the work and the healing and the going inside and the digging really deep to really find some form of answers to this trauma that I experienced as a 9-year-old has been my work. It's been my needing to face the different aspects of what this has meant in my life and how much it gets digged up on various levels. So, you know, and that's a journey that I can literally almost, you know, write a book about myself and then kind of talk about for quite a long time, which I don't want to use this
sure.
interview up to do. But there's, you know, my father did something, and so did Chris Harney, and so did, you know, many others that fought on other levels, did something really huge for not only the country, but actually for humanity in its need to face the corruption and the focus that we have placed on material values that don't actually benefit a united nation. And you know, that you know, so what he gave me as a value system is what I've got to carry with me. So the solace that I've gotten is more in understanding who my father was and who I am in relation to that.
Sure.
And that, you know, that work's difficult. It's not an easy road.
Let me read something to you, Nadia, before I just go back to Chris. I'll just put this on. Being the daughter of a father that dies, no matter what age, is hard. Being the daughter of a political activist who was assassinated in front of our home as a young girl of 9 is difficult. Being the daughter of a political activist who was assassinated and murdered and whose murder was never solved or never explained in any way is even harder. So besides my memories, longing, and hardships that it all brought, I've also had to deal with and face the story in various multiple ways, because that part of my life always comes up in a public domain. And I'll park that there. That's you at you know, some of the events. I think this one was at Stellenbosch University, just reflecting on Anton Lubowski. And that's hard. Because, you know, at that particular age, trying to deal with it and having an understanding of it, that's pretty, pretty hard.
Yes.
Nadia, yeah. Let me, I think that just deserves a yes, Nadia. Let me go to Chris. Chris? So Chris, here's something that a lot of people maybe don't have an understanding of. And sometimes I don't have an understanding of, and maybe you can explain it to me. So at the trial itself, I think Janusz Waluś keeps quiet, doesn't say anything. At the trial itself, he lets it be, and whatever is, that he accepts that. I have an understanding of what you said, that he had been put maybe in a room, and he had been told various things and beaten maybe to a pulp, and, you know, I take that into consideration as well. Clive Darby Lewis and Janusz Waluś eventually go to the TRC a couple of years later, I think 2 years later after its establishment, and they suggest, amongst others, that, you know, the Conservative Party would have been involved. Andriy Strenik's name is mentioned, that they kind of got an okay from him, maybe not in the sense of asking the question and getting a yes, but they sort of got an okay from him, and they suggested it was political. All of that is denied. Why would two people at sentenced to life imprisonment, which is then later, you know, changed in essence to serving life in prison, the death sentence ultimately given to them, why would they never, ever at any point, even when Clive Darby Lewis was sick and on his deathbed, and Janusz Waluś fighting the system for parole all the years and being refused, why did nobody speak?
You know, it's such a good question. Could I just go back to Anton Lebowski and whether the book does establish who actually ordered the killing? And I think, I hope that this won't stop readers buying the book as an aside. But I think enough is there to show that the various members of the CCB, you remember the Civil Cooperation Bureau, the front in military intelligence.
Yeah, the SANDF front,
Judge Levy held a second inquest, and in the end, he named them. He said these people were responsible.
That's Harold Levy, right?
That's exactly right, Harold Levy.
1993.
He explained the roles played by people who put up lookouts outside Anton's place, how they planned it, how they carried it out, everything about how they got Acheson to do the actual murder.
Yeah.
Now, the pathetic part is that those people are in South Africa. They could be charged because, you know, this question of crimes prescribing. In other words, is there a period within which, a crime, you can't prosecute somebody anymore? You know, I think it's 18 years.
Yeah.
But murder, rape, and treason never prescribe. In other words, they never go away. Mm. So they could still, if the NPA really had some resolve, they could still charge those people who planned Anton Lebowski's murder.
But the argument, retired High Court Judge Christopher Robert Nicholson, and I'll put it to you this way, Judge, is that the NPA, and maybe there was a handshake, maybe there was a deal, the narrative is that there's an engagement after they have passed on, literally, and then there's an inquest of some kind, and then that inquest makes a finding that then is different from what something else is. And we've never seen any of the TRC recommendations actually in play. So the narrative is there that somewhere, someplace, some deal was done that forever and ever, individuals will not be booked and docked and made accountable. And only maybe after they are passing will there be real meaning given to the incident that then, you know, people were seeking answers to. What do you make of that? Because that narrative exists.
Yes, absolutely. And if you read the book, you'll see that I make out, I think, a strong case that the thing the two factors the Nats feared the most begin with an N. There was nationalization. Mm. So they feared the Freedom Charter. They feared Chris Hani because he wanted to nationalize, you know, the factors of production in South Africa. The other thing they feared were Nuremberg trials. So all those bad guys were worried that the hempen rope would be put around their necks because they murdered a lot of people.
Mm.
So they then got about how could they persuade the ANC to not have nationalization and not have Nuremberg trials. And if you read my book later on, I make out a case that the arms deal and the way they managed to get funds to the ANC were a quid pro quo for there being no nationalization and no Nuremberg trials. Mm. That's the case that I make out. So that's, I mean, you've seen the what the courts have even said, the Supreme Court of Appeal said in the Amort Timmel case. Mm. The prosecutors said they were under immense political pressure not to prosecute the people
exactly.
who killed Amort Timmel.
Mm.
So that's what the court held, you know, that the NPA must investigate that. So just to get to your other question, why have they never spilled the beans? I think they thought that Janusz Wolish would be such a bad witness, they couldn't call him because he would make his case even worse.
Mm.
The other thing is, I'm sure, and this is in my book, that he was threatened with death if he ever divulged who is, you know, who the puppet masters were. And I think Clive Darby Lewis just thought it was he wouldn't benefit by implicating other people. So I think they thought their best interests lay in that way.
Mm.
I mean, of course, the prosecution could have said to them, listen, you know, we could make you state witnesses if you bring in the big fish, we'll. But they didn't want to. I think the whole...
Well, the question was too, Chris. You know, with all of the dark side of things, how long would you have lived if you have suggested to anybody that you know these were the names in a society that you know we have now seen over 30 years of how sometimes things do happen. You know, maybe that was a question on their minds as well, and I put it also conspiracy theorist to you that you know if that particular theory is right that lots of other people were involved and they could name them, how long would Clive Darby Lewis have lived? Would he have thought if he had named anybody? That I'm sure would have played a role in him divulging.
Absolutely. So I think. You know, everybody has values in life, and probably saving your skin is the highest value in your life, and saving your property probably comes second. So I can only assume that they feared for their lives, and that's the reason they kept quiet.
Sure. Let me take Junior in Soshanguve, who's been listening. Junior, you've been listening to the conversation. You got a question?
What a very interesting conversation, because of the death of Krisani. Has always been like a pestilence on the soul of the nation.
Mm.
And for me, an interesting dynamic is when it is utilized for politicking.
Mm.
Because there was a stage whereby, I mean, the death was attributed to some people within the ANC, more especially the historical rivalry, if ever it was real, between him and Amin Thabo Mbeki.
Yeah.
And there was a time whereby I know that even Jacob Zuma has been saying for a considerable period of time that he knows that there are certain people within the ANC who are spies and all the stuff who might have planned some of these killings. So the question for me to the judge is that based on the research that he has done, is there any conclusive evidence to point that indeed a certain institution or some people might have been involved? And if ever indeed they were involved, does it include those people, foreign elements, or they might have collaborated to a certain extent with counter-revolutionary forces within the movement itself, more especially taking into consideration that the issue might have been the fact that he favored a certain political or economic system contrary to the interest or the national, to the interest of some foreign forces, more especially the British and others who might have been operating here. Are there people within the ANC who might have collaborated with those foreign forces in order to eliminate
sure. you. Junior in Soshanguve. Chris, you've spoken to some of the issues. You spoke about British intelligence. You spoke about business interests. You spoke about the Institute for Maritime Research, and you really go into that as well. And then you talk about the political dynamics of the time as well. Do you work each and every theory to its end so that, you know, as somebody who's sitting there and who then after reading the book needs to make a verdict call, I'd be able to tie enough, you know, knots together to come to some or other conclusion. I think also what he's asking is how intensely do you engage each of the conspiracy theories?
Well, he mentioned a very interesting point. That is the point about was there ANC complicity.
Yeah.
Now, What one doesn't realize is that when old Afrikaner security branch officers retire, over their brandy and cokes, they start writing their memoirs.
Mm.
And two such people, one by the name of J.G. Scholter, who writes under a pseudonym of Gunter Schickelgruber, wrote a book called High Treason.
Mm.
Now, he sets out some messages that were sent to military intelligence in, you know, the old intelligence forces,
mm.
that really set out the plans to kill Chris Hani. So we have, in fact, chapter and verse of complicity by the ANC in Chris Hani's murder. So there is almost chapter and verse on it. So that's also a very interesting part of the equation.
Mm.
So it may well have been that there were forces that aligned themselves, you know, enemies of Hani within the ANC and the right-wing forces of military intelligence that then got together. I don't know if you ever saw a film called Murder on the Orient Express, where mm-hmm. more than one person mm-hmm. in the end kills the victim, you know. Mm-hmm. So you can have a multiplicity of characters who are seeing Chris Hani as a menace for the South Africa that they want. You know, when Mandela spoke about Chris Hani, he spoke about the enemies of change that demonized him. So my book is really trying to identify the enemies of change, because I think if Chris Hani had survived, this would be a really different country completely. So
Mandela also said, it needed to be investigated until the truth was known. I'm not sure ultimately whether he was in a position to ultimately know the truth, apart from the two that maybe went to jail. But he purposefully said it needed to be investigated until the truth was known, and that stood out at the time as well.
Sure. You know, I don't know if time is running out.
We've got about 4 minutes, Chris. Chris, yeah?
You know, I have decided that a large portion of my royalty should go to Nadia's project, you know, the Anton Lebovsky Educational Trust, because it's a marvelous trust. She can tell you about it, but I think she's a wonderfully brave girl. There's Lebovsky blood in her, you know, die appel val nie ver van die boom.
Van die boom nie, yeah.
So I think you should ask her about that, because it's such a wonderful project. And from my point of view, it would be incredible that my book with the revelations would go towards creating something that's tangible for people in Philippi, her project, who suffer such such hardships.
Chris, I gave you the first word. Chris, I'll give the last word to Nadia. Nadia... And in essence, this is the question. I'll put it in a different way, but Chris has sort of, you know, put a foundation on it and suggested, you know, what he will do with the proceeds and everything. But how do you carry Anton Lebovsky's name forward? I know that you're extremely busy in that. You every single year there is something done also to you know, commemorate and to speak to Anton's, you know, name and what he did. How are you carrying on with that legacy, in essence?
Thank you so much, Chris, for that, and thank you for giving me the opportunity to speak about it. The thing that I do just want to ask you, is there any chance that you would consider doing another interview once you've...
Absolutely. No, Nadia, as I was going to round up this and say thank you, I was also going to say I need to bring you back.
Yes, it would be absolutely amazing, because the thing that I just want to point out in this whole conversation is that South Africa and, you know, Namibia have the biggest gap between rich and poor in the world. And especially a country like Namibia, who has 3 million people, why is there anyone there that's hungry or doesn't have, a roof over their head?
Mm.
That has to be looked at. So I don't know if you know, because you keep mentioning the word conspiracy theory, you have something called follow the money, right?
Yeah.
So and that just really needs to be explored. And I want to read a quote, but I'm not going to read now. I think I'll keep it for when we come back.
Sure.
meantime, I just want to say that we have such a big problem in South Africa of children that do not have a good education. They do not have safe places to go where they get to learn and explore and you know, develop creative thinking and develop problem solving and to really be in a place where their brains that naturally want to learn get to learn. And I spent my life, you know, becoming a teacher, but also in wanting to carry my dad's legacy forward in how important education is. And it's ultimately the only way we're really going to make a difference. Mm. So we started that University of Educational Trust, and I would really love, in, you know, all the listeners to go look at alet.org.za, so that's alet.org.za, to look at the project that we're now you know, putting together to implement. And I've been working on it since 2009, and our communities need our attention. Mm. And Chris's book just basically lays out for you why we have these situations in our country, why we have these situations in Africa. And the moment we can look that in the face and go, okay, this is what we're going to do, then we can actually really make a difference in the country.
Sure.
And I just want to encourage people to take up that baton and say, we can actually really do something.
Nadia? Sorry, Nadia, you vanished there. We can really do something. Nadia, I'm going to say, and obviously, Nadia, here comes that moment. I need to bring you back, and the conversation really just can't be done in an hour. So you will get a phone call that says, Nadia, let's just talk bigger and broader into all the other issues that you've just been touching upon now. Thank you so much for coming on to Power Perspective.
Thank you so much for your time.
Nadia Lubowski, of course, daughter of Anton Lubowski, talking to us there. Chris Nicholson, before you go, can I ask you something?
Yes, certainly.
And just you think about it as I leave you with it. Patrice Lumumba, September 1961. Dag Hammarskjöld, September 1961. Olof Palme, February 1986. Brent Carlson, December 1988. Anton Lubowski, September 1989. Patrice Lumumba, September. Dag Hammarskjöld, September. Anton Lubowski, September. What is it about September that assassinations begin to happen and just planned? I was looking at the dates when I was preparing for this interview, and I was like, what is it about September?
You know, I've never even thought about that, except I'll just say Bernd Carlson was the 21st of December, and I'd just say...
April,
so, but the others, I take your point.
Yeah, Anton Lubowski, September. Dag Hammarskjöld, September. Patrice Lumumba, September. Yeah, maybe it's the killing season, yeah.
I never thought of it, Denzel. I'll try and think about it. Is it stars? Is it
It's bizarre. It's absolutely bizarre, Chris.
Yes, bizarre.
I'll give you another September date, Chris.
Yes.
September 2008. Your judgment.
Oh. Yes. That's for another day, Denzel.
That's for another day, Chris. Thank you so much for coming on.
Thanks, Denzel.
Thank you, Chris Nicholson. Yeah. Chris Nicholson. Yeah, and also the daughter of Anton Lubowski. Thank you so much for coming on board. I'll tell you why Chris Nichol, the judge is also famous, Christopher Robert Nicholson. Remember the famous 2008 judgment? Dismissed criminal charges against, Jacob Zuma. He said there was a political conspiracy. He said it was political meddling. And he said the timing of the charges.
You've been listening to a Power 98.7 podcast. For more podcasts, visit power987.co.za or subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.